handed off to me a study, I think it was probably done in Sabbath school, on the seven trumpets, which identifies that the seven trumpets take place after the close of probation. And in order to develop that argument, they have to address what Sister White says in the Great Controversy, and they do, and they undermine that. And well, I don't. It wasn't a sermon. It's a handout. I have the handout up here. let's get to the end of the meeting before we go there. All right. Anyway. Back to your notes on the three woes, and if you look closely at the characteristics of the fifth trumpet, which is the first woe, what's illustrated in Revelation 9, those symbols, the pioneers correctly identified what that passage meant, and they identified it as the beginning of Islam, the historical figure. There's always a historical figure associated with each of the trumpets. And the historical figure associated with the fifth trumpet, the first woe, is Muhammad, introduction of the religion of Islam. Muhammad is a spiritual descendant of Ishmael. And in that time period, Islam was to torment, and it very specifically says there in the fifth trumpet, they were going to torment the armies of Rome. And the warfare against European Rome during that time period that was carried out by the armies of Islam was very disorganized and random. But when the sixth trumpet, the second woe, comes into history, it's Islam once again, but it's Islam whose base, point of ruling, has moved from Arabia and the Arabian Peninsula to Turkey. And the historical figure that is associated with the sixth trumpet, the second woe, is Ottoman. And it's the Ottoman Empire that encompasses the history of the sixth trumpet, the second woe. And it's in this history that Revelation 9 says that the armies of Rome would be killed. The first woe would torment the armies of Rome. The second woe would kill the armies of Rome. It was this, when the pioneers identify what's represented in the sixth trumpet, the second woe, in terms of how the armies of Islam would attack. It was the same with only one difference. They would strike suddenly and unexpectedly, but in this history, gunpowder was invented. So pioneers identify that in the sixth trumpet, it was the Islam would kill the armies of Rome, and the mode of warfare of Islam would be that they would strike suddenly and unexpectedly with explosives. For the first time in history. And they were also directed by their heads and their tails. And Isaiah tells us this is the prophet that teaches lies. And this is still a characteristic of Islam in today. These people that are blowing themselves up as suicide bombers are being directed by the imams. They're the religious leaders that are sitting back in the mosque calling the shots. And that was one of the characteristics of Islam, even in the first and second woe. So, we're suggesting that when you put these characteristics together, that the Bible has identified three woes, and upon a triple application of prophecy, the first two times that the prophecy is fulfilled will establish the characteristics of the third time it is fulfilled. So we're suggesting that when the third woe arrives in history, who is it going to be? First off, in the first and second woe, it was Islam. So we're saying that the third woe is going to be Islam. And in the first and second woe, who was Islam attacking? The armies of Rome. So we're saying that when the third woe arrives, Islam, once again, will be attacking the armies of Rome. Who's the armies of Rome at the end of the world? It's the United States. Different army of Rome at the end of the world. And we're saying that the mode of warfare identified in the first and second woe was that it was Islam striking suddenly and unexpectedly with explosives. So, we're suggesting that when the third woe arrives in history, that we should expect to see radical Islam attack the United States suddenly and unexpectedly with explosives. And when that happens, you know that you're in the time period of the third woe. You should expect that Islam is being directed by their imams and their you know, religious leaders. That's what's going on. And if you go back to Genesis 16, when you consider that Islam has always, the descendants of Ishmael have a connection to God's kingdom, that they have a relationship to it all the way through sacred history, and then you realize that Ishmael had 12 princes, they call it in the Bible, but 12 sons, the Bible calls them princes, and that Jacob had 12 sons, and that Jacob pronounced a blessing upon all 12 of his sons, and the blessing that Jacob pronounced on his 12 sons, he predicted their role at the end of the world. Go read the blessings that Jacob put upon his sons. And it wasn't just a blessing on them for then and there. It specifically identified the role that each of those 12 descendants would play at the end of the world. So when you come to Genesis 16, verse 12, you realize that there's a prediction about Ishmael at the end of the world. And you have every right prophetically to project this towards his descendants at the end of the world the same way that the pronouncement of Jacob's sons was directed towards the end of the world. And verse 12 of Genesis 16 says, "And he will be a wild man. His hand will be against every man, and every man's hand will be against him, and he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren." The descendants of Ishmael at the end of the world are going to be wild men. But the important ingredients here for us to see a Seventh-day Adventist understanding that the message of the hour has to do with the Sunday law is Bible prophecy is teaching here that the catalyst that brings every man's hand together at the end of the world is radical Islam. Radical Islam is the issue through that torments the United States and eventually brings down modern Babylon. It is the catalyst that brings all mankind together against it at the end of the world. So if you go, the third woe, if you look at it, triple application of prophecy, what we're saying very simply, based upon a triple application of prophecy, when you look at the characteristics of the first woe and combine them with the characteristics of the second woe, then on September 11, 2001, the third woe arrived in history. And the work of Islam and Bible prophecy to bring about the Sunday law in the United States and the one world government that follows began. It began 5 years ago. And Seventh-day Adventists are still sleeping. And you can, and this is a brief presentation of the three woes, but brothers and sisters, God's truth is simple. You may not believe it, you may not have tested it yet, but you at least understood the logic. It's pretty simple to see the logic if you see upon the testimony of two things established. But also, the understanding of the first and second woes is established on the 1843 chart, which Sister White says was directed by the hand of the Lord and should not be altered. The foundational truths that are expressed on that chart are the foundational truths that pull together the end of the world message that Seventh-day Adventists are to proclaim to the world. Now, I know that some of you haven't looked closely at some parts of prophecy. I assume that. But let me run through some scriptures here. And without defending them, there's not enough time to go through all the defenses of them, but maybe you can see some of the logic in this. Turn to Revelation 17. Verse 12. And we've been recommending to you here a 40-hour prophecy school. And in the 40-hour prophecy school, we give a very strong presentation on Revelation 17, where we make a defense from beginning to end on what we're going to suggest. And I'm going to pull a verse or two out of here without making a defense. So I know that I may lose some of you, but we'll try to keep it simple. Verse 12 says, "And the 10 horns which thou sawest are 10 kings which have received no kingdom as yet." Whoever these 10 horns are, they only receive one kingdom, no kingdom. And we're suggesting that these 10 horns represent the civil power at the end of the world. Because at the end of the world, the story is about the combination of church and state. Civil authority, church authority. The church at the end of the world is papacy. Nobody has a hard time with that. But they're unsure about the United Nations being these 10 kings. But it says they've received no kingdom. So whoever these 10 kingdoms are, 10 kings are, brothers and sisters, they're representing one kingdom. It doesn't say they've received no kingdoms. It's kingdom. But received power as kings 1 hour with the beast. Whoever this group of 10 is, when they receive power as a kingdom, they rule with the papacy, the beast. The papacy is the beast of Bible prophecy. Even though I know there's people that teach otherwise, the beast in Revelation is the papacy. And these 10 kings are going to rule together because it says they receive power for 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for He is Lord of lords and King of kings. Let me show you something here. Upon the testimony of two things established, keep your finger in Revelation 17. Go to Psalm 83. Remember, it says these 10 kings have one mind, and that they're going to make war against Christ. How are they going to make war against Christ? They're going to persecute His people. If you go to Psalm 83, Psalm 83 says, verse 1, "Keep not thou silence, O God, hold not thy peace, and be not still, O God. For lo, thine enemies make a tumult, and they that hate thee have lifted up the head. They have taken crafty counsel against thy people, and consulted against thy hidden ones. They have said, Come, and let us cut them off from being a nation." Here's a group of people, it's saying they, this is a group of people, that they're going to do the same thing as these 10 kings. They're going to cut God's people off from being a nation. It says, "They have said," verse 4, "Come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance, for they have consulted together with one consent." And if you have a marginal reference for consent, it's heart. Remember, the 10 kings in Revelation 17 are of what? One mind. This group is of one consent, one heart. It's the same group. It says, "They are confederate against thee." This is the end of the world confederacy. And then if you read verses 6 downward, and you count how many are in this confederacy. Let's count them together. Verse 6, "The tabernacles of Edom, 1. The Ishmaelites, 2. Moab, 3. Hagarenes, 4. Gabal, 5. Ammon, 6. Amalek, 7. The Philistines, 8. Tyre, 9. Asher, 10. Okay? This is the 10 kings of Revelation 17 that come into a confederacy to persecute God's people. All right, testimony of two things established. And don't trip up where it says in verse 8, it says Asher is joined with them. They have holpen the children of Lot. The children of Lot are Ammon and Moab, and they've already been mentioned. The children of Lot is a general term in Bible prophecy for all of God's enemies. It's 10 tribes that are listed here. This is the 10 kings. A confederacy that comes together. And who's it come together with? Go back to Revelation 17. It comes together with the beast, okay? The papacy. So we've already looked at Elijah, right? Elijah, who was the impure church in Elijah's story?
Jezebel.
Who was she married to?
Ahab.
Was Ahab a king?
Yeah.
In Bible prophecy, does a king represent civil power?
Yeah.
What was Ahab the king of?
Ten tribes.
Brothers and sisters, the 10 kings of Revelation 17 is the civil power that comes into a church-state relationship with the papacy at the end of the world. Now, if you're back in Revelation 17, if you have an Ellen White study Bible, she quotes verses 13 and 14 of Revelation 17. And this is from Manuscript 24, 1891. But verse 13 says, "These have one mind." So she quotes verses 13 and 14 of Revelation 17, and she says this, "These have one mind, there will be a universal bond of unity, union, one great harmony, a confederacy of Satan's forces." What were these 10 tribes in Psalm 83? They were a confederacy. These 10 kings are a confederacy. Now, brothers and sisters, what does the word universal mean? Does it mean Europe? This is a worldwide confederacy that comes together with the papacy at the end of the world. And why do they come together? Because Salome, or the prophets of Baal, or the USA, forces the world to do so. Brothers and sisters, go back to Revelation. One more verse before we go to Revelation 13. Look at verses 17 of Revelation 17. Still talking about the ten horns, the ten kings. It says, for God hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast. They're the seventh kingdom of Bible prophecy, and it very, very plainly says that when they finally get control of the world, when they finally are empowered as the United Nations, the one world government, in order to be empowered, they have to strike an agreement to rule together for 1 hour with the papacy. They agree to give their kingdom to the beast. This is when church and state comes together at the end of the world. Now, go to Revelation 13. Verse 11. Most Seventh-day Adventists are familiar with the understanding of verse 11. It says, and I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. This is the United States of America when it passes the Sunday law. When it speaks as a dragon, Sister White plainly says, that this isn't my extrapolating on it, when the United States speaks as a dragon, this is when the Sunday law is passed. She says, at the same time, and she plainly says this, at the same time, the image of the beast has been formed in the United States. It's clear. Now, most Adventists, you tell them this the first time around, and they shake their head and they agree with it, but it's not sinking down in. Brothers and sisters, in verse 11 of Revelation 13, Sister White is crystal clear. You don't need Sister White, but it's easy with Sister White, with Adventists. When the United States speaks as a dragon, the mark of the beast is enforced, and the image of the beast is fully formed in the United States. And there's only one definition of the image of the beast. Sister White says it a lot of ways. But it's the combination of church and state with the church in control of the relationship. She says, when the church uses secular power to enforce or sustain its religious decrees and dogma, it's the combination of church and state with the church in control of the relationship. And I have the quotes. We're keeping it simple for this point. Brothers and sisters, when the United States speaks as a dragon, the mark of the beast goes forward, and the image of the beast has been formed in the United States. Do you follow me on that logic so we can move one step further? Everyone can see that. In Great Controversy, Sister White says, the speaking of the nation is the action of its legislative and judicial authorities. When the United States speaks as a dragon in verse 11 of Revelation 13, that's an action of the Congress. She says, the speaking of the nation is the action of its legislative and judicial authorities. Everybody remember reading that quote? So let's read on, verse 12. And he, the United States, exercise all the power of the first beast before him, and causeth the earth and them that dwell therein to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. And he, the United States, doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on earth inside of men. Where do we get this? Where's John get this geographical illustration from? That story of Elijah. This is connecting the United States with the story of Elijah. And what is the United States doing here? It's doing the dance of deception. It's doing the work of the prophets of Baal or Salome. This is one of the strongest biblical arguments that the United States is the false prophet of Revelation 16. It's the one that deceives. Look at verse 14. And deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do inside of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth. Now notice what the United States does. Where are we in verse 14? In verse 14, we are after the Sunday law in the United States. The image of the beast has already been formed in the United States. And she's already spoke as a dragon. And in verse 14, the United States saying to them to dwell on the earth that they should make an image of the beast. After the United States passes the Sunday law, the United States, Sister White says, national apostasy is followed by national ruin. And it's clear immediately after the Sunday law in the United States that Satan then appears to personate Christ. So you have an escalation of catastrophes and disasters immediately after the Sunday law. Satan's there, along with the lost religious leaders, saying, hey, it's these Sabbath keepers in the United States that are causing these problems, and everything's escalating and getting worse, and things are falling apart, and radical Islam is doing its work of fulfilling its role in Bible prophecy, striking suddenly and unexpectedly with explosives. And the United States goes to the world and says to the world, you need to set up an image of the beast. And there's only one definition of the image of the beast, brothers and sisters. There's only one. It's a combination of church and state with the church in control of the relationship. In verse 14, when the United States tells the people of the earth they have to set up an image of the beast, it's telling the people of the earth that they have to come under the umbrella of a one world government. They have to come under the authority of the United Nations, and the whole world's going to say, no way. We're not going to come under the authority of the United States or the United Nations. We don't have confidence in either one of you. And they're going to strike an agreement. And the agreement is, we're going to put the world under a one world government. And so everyone can feel comfortable about it. We're going to put the greatest moral authority in the world today on the head of the arrangement, the Pope of Rome. And in verse 15, if you don't think this is a one world government, verse 15 says, and he, the United States, had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak. This world image of the beast is going to speak. And Sister White says, the speaking of a nation is the action of its legislative and judicial authorities. This world image of the beast has a legislative and judicial branch. Does the United Nations have a legislative branch now? Does it have a judicial branch now? It's already here. It's already here. But why does the world do this? The world does it because the world's fallen apart. National apostasy is followed by national ruin. The judgments of God are already in the land, brothers and sisters. We've spent time talking about some of these historical components of Adventism. We haven't spent any time here this week talking about the fact that the judgments of God are in the land today, but they are. They only escalate to the Sunday law, and then it gets worse. The judgments of God are in the land. Radical Islam's doing its work. And when you go to this history, when you go to this history here, Revelation 13:2, we mentioned it last time, but let's read it to you this time. Revelation 13:2 says, and the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power, seat, and great authority. Brothers and sisters, standard, correct Adventist understanding is that this beast is the papacy, and the dragon here is representing pagan Rome. What pagan Rome gave to the papacy? It gave three things to the papacy. It moved to Constantinople and left the papacy in the city of Rome. It gave its seat to the city of Rome, to the papacy, in the year 330. Justinian gave the civil authority to the papacy in the year 533 by identifying the Pope of Rome as the head of the churches and the corrector of heretics. The civil authority was given to the papacy in 533. And the power, the military strength and the economic power of pagan Rome was given from 496 when Clovis entered into a church-state relationship with the papacy on through 508 when the last of the seven kings entered into that church-state relationship, that being King Arthur, and they continued to give their military and economic strength to it afterwards. But this is where the church-state alliance came in. And brothers and sisters, it's the United States that gives the power to the papacy. It's the United Nations that supplies the civil authority. And it's the papacy that's going to be seated upon this whole arrangement. But here's something I want you to see, if you will. If you go back to the pioneers and you see what they write about these histories, what they write about the year 533, it's not an accident. They tell you this, that in 533, the emperor of the Roman Empire, Justinian, his empire was falling apart. The trumpets of Revelation were already blowing. The Roman Empire was being disintegrated into 10 kingdoms and beyond. It was the two of the three horns were already gone by 533. Warfare had been going on for a couple hundred years. And Justinian, the head of the civil aspect of the Roman Empire, was trying to do what he could to keep the kingdom together. And what did he do? He entered into a religious controversy that was going on in the kingdom. And the controversy was, is the church at Constantinople the preeminent church? Or is the church at Rome the preeminent church? And in 533, Justinian made a legal document, which when the pioneers speak about this history, they almost always quote the whole document. That's how significant it was in their mind. And in that document, he identified the Pope of Rome as the head of the churches. The Roman church is the preeminent church. But he also identified the Pope of Rome as the corrector of heretics. And it's at that point that the Roman emperors surrendered their civil authority, because the Pope could turn around right then and there, if he wanted to the emperor and say, you're a heretic, off with your head. So what am I saying? I'm saying that when we reach the end of the world, the 10 kings are once again going to give their civil authority to the Pope of Rome. And you know when they're going to do it? They're going to do it just like before, when the whole world's falling apart. Why is it falling apart? Because radical Islam, the third woe, is doing its work of bringing every man's hand together against radical Islam. The world's being brought to its knees by this. I mean, how you look at what's going on with Islam. They're not reasonable. They're not going to stop. Bush isn't going to stop. Don't you see that? This isn't going to stop. It's going to escalate. That's what Bible prophecy says. They're going to bring... Let me ask it this way. Do you think if Ben Laden could get a nuclear bomb into one of the cities in the United States that he'd go ahead and do it? Yes, that's where we're at in history. And Bible prophecy says that the descendants of Ishmael are wild men, and their hands against every man, and every man's hand will be against them. And the first woe and the second woe was Islam striking suddenly and unexpectedly with explosives against the armies of Rome, and it's only going to escalate. And by the time the Sunday law passes, because first the United States is tormented to the Sunday law, Sunday law, national apostasy is followed by national ruin. And then the United States goes out to the whole world and says, you need to set up an image of the beast. You must come under the umbrella of a one world government with the papacy in control. And you know what? It's the identical history. The world's falling apart. And the civil government says, okay, we're going to solve a religious crisis. Only this time it's not the religious crisis. Is the church in Constantinople preeminent or is the Roman church preeminent? What's the religious crisis? Radical Islam. Radical Islam. And as soon as the Pope has been given this authority, brothers and sisters, the whole world's going to find out it wasn't about radical Islam. It's about Adventism. And the ten kings are going to make war against the Lamb. That's what's going on in Bible prophecy. And the issue that brings it together, the catalyst that brings the crisis, according to Bible prophecy, is the third woe. And the third woe is identified by maintaining the pioneer understanding of the first two woes as illustrated on this chart that Sister White says was directed by the hand of the Lord. Amen. But sisters, we're at the end of the world. And Bible prophecy is clarifying what's going on. But by and large, it's like the days of Elijah. Elijah comes to the people. I'm not saying I don't read anything into it. No, I'm not saying I'm Elijah. I'm just saying it's like the story of Elijah. Elijah comes to the people, including me. And what did the people, including me, say to Elijah?
Nothing.
They answered not a word. God's people are dead asleep. They need to awaken to their role, their responsibility, and their privilege. This is the time period every prophet wanted to live in and participate in. And here we are deciding whether we're willing to do our part to make ourselves available for the Holy Spirit to use. To the old path. So, any questions?
The third woe is the seventh trumpet.
Good question. The third woe is the seventh trumpet, but the seventh trumpet, although they're the same, the seventh trumpet in verse 7 of Revelation 10, the trumpet itself, the sounding of the seventh trumpet, is identifying the development of the 144,000, identifying when the mystery of godliness would be finished. It's finished in the Day of Atonement. So when you look at the seventh trumpet, what the trumpet itself is representing, it's representing the development of the 144,000, and the woe is emphasizing the part of that history that brings the crisis into the prophetic history that finishes probation. They're the same, but they're two aspects. And you can see in both the first and second woe, you can see the development of the people, because in the fifth trumpet, the first woe, there's a pronouncement, hurt not those that have the seal of God. And then in the time period of this second woe, the sixth trumpet, you have 1840 to 1844, the pioneer time period, which is repeated at the end of the world.
The seventh trumpet, is it not true that it's connected with the close of the time prophecy, that time shall be no longer? And at the end of that time prophecy, the seventh trumpet sounded.
That's right. October 22nd, 1844 is when the seventh trumpet began to sound. Revelation 10, 7. Yes.
So it blows for a long time.
Only because God's people haven't finished the work of character development. I mean, Sister White, we read a quote here early on. I know you may not remember it, but it's in your notes that the Lord could have come ere this if God's people would have finished their work.
That seventh trumpet is in connection with the trumpet that is blown on the antitypical Day of Atonement. To call the people to the Day of Atonement in ancient Israel, there was a trumpet that was sounded, and it was a distinct, they knew, and it called us to the same distinction if we understand it.
The Feast of Trumpet was, but the in the Day of Atonement there's a trumpet sounded too. But the Feast of Trumpets was 10 days before, and that's why 1833 has some relevance. 10 years before the 1843 time period, you have the falling of the stars. You have William Miller raised up
on verse 13, Revelation 13. And he doeth great wonders, so that he make a fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. You have that as the United States or the papacy?
In Great Controversy, Sister White says that's Satan. But she also says, commenting on the dragon in Revelation 12. In Great Controversy, when she's commenting on the dragon of Revelation 12, she says the dragon in Revelation 12 is Satan. But in a secondary sense, it is pagan Rome. So that statement gives you the right to identify primary and secondary meanings of Bible prophecy. So when you can show very specifically, and you need to be very specific because some people put it in the wrong place. After the Sunday law in the United States, Satan appears to personate Christ. And Sister White's very clear he's allowed to do so until Michael stands up. From the Sunday law until the close of human probation, Satan's on the scene personating Christ. So Satan will be here doing his work that is represented by verse 13. But this is also the United States. And the United States will be deceiving people through... the United States has two aspects to it, religious and civil. And its civil power is going to be forcing people to accept the mark of the beast through economic and military sanctions. That's prophetically the deception it's doing. And then the religious aspect of the United States is that it's going to be participating in the philosophy of accepting the Sunday law through the fallen churches, which, one of the primary symbols of the religion that they've taken up is the tongues of fire and the charismatic movement. So I know there's some people that apply this to the charismatic movement in the United States. Some people apply it to the weaponry of the United States, bringing fire down out of heaven. And I don't have a problem seeing it as both, but Sister White says, it's Satan. So I think it's all of them.
Earlier tonight, you mentioned 2 Thessalonians 2, and I haven't had a chance to look this up, but in verse 9, chapter 2, verse 9, even him whose coming is after the working of Satan with all power and signs and lying wonders. From what I understand, have you looked at the Greek word there? Apparently that word coming that's the impersonation of Christ at that point. The Greek word is only used for the second coming of Christ.
Parousia, is that how you pronounce it?
I'm not sure.
I think the Greek word is parousia, but you obviously know more than I, so I won't get off on that one or I'll get in trouble. But this is a theologian, and there's many times in his own, when he's writing this book, he used theological terms in it. It's a stumbling block for me, but that's my problem, not his. And he uses parousia a lot to identify the second coming, and I think that's this word here. But don't hold me to it. Is that you just noting that? Or you have a question?
I'm sort of wondering how that fits with, if you had insight on it, how it fits with everything else you were saying on 2 Thessalonians 2.
Well, if in verse 7 it says, for the mystery of iniquity, the papacy, doth already work, only he who now letteth will let until he be taken out of the way. Only pagan Rome will continue to restrain the papacy until it's removed, and then shall that wicked be revealed. And I think it's William Miller has a statement where he's real plain and specific, that wicked is the papacy, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming, even him whose coming is after the working of Satan with all powers and signs and lying wonders. So how does the flow of events sound to everyone here? I know how it sounds to me, but I'm not prepared to say. Isn't it talking about the Lord there? His coming's after the working of Satan?
Right.
Is that how it sounds to you? But I yeah. No, in the verse 9 is what we're dealing with. Even him, the added word, so who's coming? The Lord will destroy with the brightness of his coming, whose coming is after the working of Satan. It's to me, it's talking about the second coming of Christ taking place after the marvelous work of Satan. Is that how you understand it?
It's just one of those.
Because that's what he did.
That takes some thought.
Yeah. Pardon me?
It takes some thought to make sure it's in the right sequence or if it fits or you know what I mean? It's something you have to digest for a period of time.
No, I think it's who's coming, Christ's coming there by the context of verse 8. Destroy with the brightness of coming, eliminate the even him, that's an added word, will destroy with the brightness of his coming, whose coming, Christ's coming, whose coming is after the marvelous working of Satan. It begins at the Sunday law in the United States.
And verse 11 gives context to that thought because it says, well, verse 10 and 11 says, and with all the people from unrighteousness, then they perish because they receive not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this cause, verse 10 says, and with all the deceivableness,
verse 10 says, and with all deceivableness and unrighteousness, and them that perish, because they receive not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this cause, God shall send them strong delusion, that they should believe a lie. So he's saying there that because of the miracle-working power of Satan, just before the second coming, there's going to be people deceived because they're going to believe a lie. So the rest of the context of the of Paul's statement would confirm that before Christ's coming, Satan is going to be doing these things because the people are going to believe a lie.
Are you satisfied? No? You don't look satisfied.
I'm picking up implied statements. And so, what do you say at that point? It's not saying certain things explicitly, and so by implication with context here, we have the second coming of Christ. We have signs and lying wonders, as he was mentioning, with all deceivableness of unrighteousness and them that perish. And verse 11, for this cause God shall send them strong delusion that they should believe a lie. So by implication, there's a lot of things going on in there. And implication, the impersonation of Christ before the second coming of Christ.
Right. You can show that. And if you, we have a study called the Crowning Act where we pulled many. When I first became an Adventist out in the desert of California, there was a sister and husband there that printed a book. And they taught that Satan appeared before the Sunday law, and they stated plainly in their book, you don't have to do any preparation, you just have to wait till Satan personates Christ, and then you know the Sunday law is coming. So years ago, I started looking at that, and it's very clear in the Bible and the Spirit of Prophecy that after the Sunday law in the United States, Satan appears to do his marvelous work of deception, and she has a statement, black and white, he's allowed to do so until human probation closes. That is the time period that we call the little time of trouble. That's where he's there physically there doing his work after the United States fully disconnected itself from unrighteousness. And then there's nothing, no one to deceive after human probation closes. It's over with. Then the seven last plagues. But anyway, are there any other questions? Yes.
In reference to what you were just speaking about, the personation of Christ. You said it was before the national...
No, it's after.
After the national Sunday law?
The husband and wife are teaching this in their book. It's okay. After. And okay. You see it in Revelation 13. First, the United States speaks as a dragon, and then you see verse 13, Satan calling fire down out of heaven, Sister White says.
So as far as the 144,000, are they tempted by this personation if their probation is already closed?
Well, you're... Your question is making a conclusion. So I can answer. I can try to answer your question, but I got to point out a conclusion that you've implied in your question. You're suggesting that if the Sunday law in the United States, the 144,000 are developed, and I don't think you can make that argument. At the Sunday law in the United States, God's people in the United States are either going to receive the mark of the beast or the seal of God. But the only thing you can really be certain about the 144,000 from Scripture is that when Michael stands up and human probation closes altogether, which is a while after the Sunday law in the United States. First, the United States passes the Sunday law, then every country on the globe follows her example, Sister White says. When Michael stands up, those people that are still alive with the seal of God at that time will live to the end, and you can call them the 144,000. And you can do that without making a distinction whether they're literal or symbolic. I'm not saying that at that point. But there's no reason to... I don't think there's any suggestion. I don't think there's any argument that you can draw from Scripture or Spirit of Prophecy that would show that the people that receive the seal of God at the Sunday law in the United States may not get laid to rest before the Lord returns. They will receive the seal of God, but... The argument you can make on as far as being laid to rest is if you have the seal of God, when Michael stands up and human probation closes, then you can argue, okay, that person lives till the second coming of Christ. But I don't think you can make the argument, and in your question, you asked that. You implied that, whether you meant to or not. So I want to at least address that. But in Testimonies, Volume 5, page 216, she says, those that receive the seal of God at the Sunday law, their character will remain pure and spotless for eternity. So if you receive the seal of God at the Sunday law in the United States and then Satan appears, I don't think you're going to be under severe temptation. You're going to be under persecution from him. I think it's going to be not like the people in the world that are still making their decision for or against Sabbath and Sunday.
So will they be tempted by Satan's personation is what I was trying to get at.
I don't think so, but I don't know. Do you have some kind of light on that? I don't think so. It doesn't make sense to me because when you have the seal of God during this time period, she says, your character remains pure and spotless for eternity. And to me, a simple definition of someone that has the seal of God is that you would rather die than sin. So I don't see that condition of character under the temptation that he's bringing upon the world.
But it says, if it were possible, he would deceive the very elect.
Even in the time of Jacob's trouble, after human probation's closed, we're going to be, do I have an unconfessed sin? There's going to be those types of temptations. But what I'm talking about is a temptation where you flip-flop over and receive the mark of the beast.
I think the answer is right there. If possible means that there is not possible. It's not possible. That's what it's saying.
My wife and I were discussing last night the things we've been learning since Sabbath last and during the week. And if I'm not mistaken, we started off this discussion on Sabbath by a text from Habakkuk. Is that true?
Yes.
And that is that he who runs, who readeth, may run who readeth it, right? That's
right.
What Habakkuk says. Will you quick give them a short, because we are running out of time, give them a short, if you would, the connection of that Millerite chart and how it is, if we will study these things out, we will be able to run who readeth it. Just very quickly. What I learned from this week was this, that we have some stuff to overlay at the end of the world off of that chart to the experience of Adventism today. And if we will take the modern equivalent of what made the Millerites run who readeth it, and match wits with Miller and lay it down in our day and overlay it to the events that are happening in our church and in our world today. And if we will study that chart out and match history with history, we are going to be able to run who readeth it. Is that not correct?
Yeah, and the only other thing that I would emphasize in connecting convict them to produce this chart, but it was one of the components of that history. And when they reached the point to where they had developed that chart and the chart was being understood by them as present truth, they were recognizing that the Lord was the one that produced that chart and led them to produce that chart and put things on that chart in Habakkuk 2 they hadn't even seen until they needed to see it. They didn't even though they were convicted Habakkuk 2 was just for them, it was present truth, they didn't realize until they needed to realize it that in Habakkuk 2 it talks about a tarrying time. So when they hit the first disappointment, suddenly they realized the present truth message of Habakkuk 2, that the Lord had provided a special verse in there to say, hey, yeah, you're going to have a first disappointment, but you carry on. When they reached that point in their history, when they were understanding the significance of those passages in this chart, then the punchline of Ezekiel 12 and Habakkuk 2 is that the vision no longer tarries. Therefore, when you repeat that history at the end of the world and you're suddenly, you realize the Lord is removing the seal from the seven thunders and He's removing His hand from this chart, you've reached the point where the vision that is present truth at the end of the world no longer tarries. And the vision at the end of the world isn't Daniel 8:14. It's the third angel's message. The Sunday law is about to hit the United States. It's not going to tarry any longer.
In regards to the sister up front, these are my words, but I know it's worded perfect, that we will be so grounded into the truth that we won't be able to be moved. Yep. And I don't know where it's at.
The ceiling is a settling into the truth, both spiritually truth and intellectually, so that we will not be moved.
And right there, when we get to that point, then even if we're tempted, we won't be moved.
Lloyd? Lloyd has a question. Are you going to ask one, Harold?
Nope. In defense of what I was saying and what... Oh, is it open? Yeah. Okay. I understand.
Yeah, I wasn't arguing against you. I was trying to make a point, but go ahead.
I
know what you're going to talk
about.
From.
But you have a quote in here on page 16... Christ Object Lessons 4:12 to 4:13. It says, "It is in a crisis that character is revealed. When the earnest voice proclaimed at midnight, 'Behold, the bridegroom cometh, go ye out to meet him,' and the sleeping virgins were roused from their slumbers, it was seen who had made preparation for the event. Both parties were taken unawares, but one was prepared for the emergency, and the other was found without preparation. So now, a sudden and unlooked for calamity, something that brings the soul face to face with death, will show whether there is any real faith in the promises of God. It says it will show whether the soul is sustained by grace. The great final test comes at the close of human probation, and it will be too late for the soul's need to be supplied." And then the skipping a paragraph, it says, "We cannot be ready to meet the Lord by waking when the cry is heard, 'Behold, the bridegroom.'" So, the first time we have the ten virgins, you agreed, the parable of ten virgins has to do with judgment. You go along with that. The first application of the ten virgins, "Behold, the bridegroom," Christ came, entered the most holy place, and the judgment of the dead began, right?
Right.
And right at that moment, "Behold the bridegroom," when he came, what did the foolish virgins do? They left. So now we have the second application of the ten virgins coming up relating to the Sunday law. So this, when it says, "Behold the bridegroom," has to be the second phase of the judgment, which is, you agreed, the judgment of the living.
Okay.
And
maybe so, but
okay, but
the point is, what
okay,
are you saying?
The point is, in the parable, they awake at the call of "Behold the bridegroom." This is what awakens them. right? We cannot be ready to meet the Lord by waking when the cry is heard, "Behold the bridegroom." Now, this is right at the beginning of the judgment. So, the second time, the application of the second phase of the judgment relating to 10 virgins is the beginning. When we hear, "Behold the bridegroom," is the beginning of the judgment of the living.
Okay.
And at that time, as it begins, the foolish virgins will leave. And you agreed that this comes before the Sunday law. And it is in relation to the Sunday because this calamity is what's happening in the world. And people will demand a Sunday law, and this is what,
okay,
why they leave.
Let me try to express,
right,
what you're saying that is in disagreement with me,
right,
so everyone here can understand it.
Right.
Maybe they understand it already. But I'm suggesting that the separation in Adventism takes place at the Sunday law, which parallels October 22nd, 1844. And Lloyd is suggesting that the separation actually takes place before the Sunday law.
Because that's when the judgment of the living starts.
And you're using the parable of the ten virgins, which is okay, but we have to remember we've been specifically told when it comes to parables, you can stretch them a little bit too far. But I'm not afraid to work with the parable of ten virgins. It's in August 12 through 17 at the Exeter Cap Meeting in 1844 that the midnight cry arrives. August 12th through 17th, 1844. That's the midnight cry. "Behold, the bridegroom cometh." And over the next 2 months, the midnight cry is carried. But in this time period, how many Adventists or how many Millerites are there?
50,000.
And when you come to October 22nd, on the other side of it, how many are there?
50.
So what I'm saying is that one of the key components of this is that on October 22nd, 1844, at the third angel's message, this is where the door closed in the parable.
Okay.
This is where the door closed in the Philadelphian church. And you can bring the statements to show that the door closes for Adventism at the Sunday law. And just before the Sunday law, then, I'm suggesting that the midnight cry is going to kick in repeating this during this time period. The first part of the fourth angel's message, remember, is in two parts. So you've got a midnight cry parallel that in here, we read the quote from the Great Controversy. It says, "Heretofore, those who have predicted a Sunday law have been regarded as alarmists. But as the event so long doubted is seen approaching, there will be an impetus coming to the movement that could not heretofore been." And that's a bad paraphrase, but probably everyone's familiar with that. The wise virgins are going to see the Sunday law before it arrives. It's going to bring a power. And this is the midnight cry time period that leads up to the closing of the door. And the closing of the door here, the wise and foolish virgins of Adventism receive the mark of the beast or the seal of God. Where I agree with you, is that We've already separated from the truth before the Sunday law. If we're going to receive the mark of the beast, we're settled into error before then and truth before then. But you suggest that before the Sunday law, those in Adventism that are going to receive the mark of the beast physically leave the church before the Sunday law.
Yes, because the judgment of the living begins before the Sunday law. But they're leaving because of the Sunday law is... they see the Sunday law coming because the populace in the United States are demanding a Sunday law. And because of the calamities that are affecting the prosperity of the nation. Right? You know those statements in Ellen G. White.
Yeah, but I know those statements, but I don't know where those statements are connected with Adventist separating. I know too many passages in prophecy that are identifying the separation at the Sunday law.
Okay, but...
Ezekiel 8.
It doesn't fit the ten verses.
Yeah, that's what I say. Parables you can stretch too far sometimes.
Well, but...
And we're told that. That's not my interpretation.
Ellen White makes the comment that the one thing that they think will never happen is that Sunday law in the United States. So when that event takes place, he catches them by surprise.
Yeah, so it doesn't catch the children of the light by surprise, but it catches the children of darkness by surprise.
Okay.
But
I see where you're coming from. But I just want to make another one. We can apply the ten virgins to Christ's second coming. And when the cry goes out, behold the bridegroom, when he's actually coming, what happens to the foolish virgins and the wicked?
Yeah, I don't have a problem applying it broader than Adventism.
Right. And then what happens right after the second coming in heaven? What goes on? There's a judgment, right?
Right.
See, the same thing. When they leave, a judgment comes. When Christ comes...
Let me ask a question. Are there any more questions? Oh, there is another question. I'm sorry. If there wasn't any more questions, I was going to have a prayer so those people that wanted to leave would leave.
Revelation 13 speaks about, I saw one of his heads that had been wounded, and the deadly wound was healed, and all the world marveled and followed the beast. Is there any indication that how long the papacy will rule the last time? The reason why I ask you this is because we know when the mortal wound was applied, 1798.
Right. So no, I don't think there is.
When did it become healed?
Well, the healing of the deadly wound is a prophetic term, so it needs to be defined by prophecy. And here's how I think prophecy defines it, and we went over it tonight. Pagan Rome and Papal Rome define modern Rome. And when the deadly wound of the papacy is healed at the end of the world, it's identifying when it can rule supremely once again. That's what its ability to rule the world was taken away in 1798. When that ability is returned to it, the deadly wound is healed. And that ability is returned to it based upon Bible prophecy when it overcomes the third obstacle that's set before it. Because in order for pagan Rome to rule the world supremely for 360 years, it had to overcome Syria, Israel, and then Egypt, and it ruled the world supremely. Papal Rome, the Heruli, the Vandals, and the Goths ruled the world supremely. When the papacy overcomes its third obstacle, which is Daniel 11, 42, and 43, Egypt. Egypt symbolizes the world. The world is the one world government. When the ten kings agree to allow the papacy take the position of moral authority over the one world government of the United Nations, then the papacy has conquered Egypt. And its deadly wound is healed.
The papacy came into power when Mussolini delivered the lands and money to
in 1929. Yeah, but see, the difference, if you look at what Sister White says, that's when the civil power was returned to the papacy. I don't have a problem with that. 1929 Lateran Treaty. But when Sister White speaks about the papacy's deadly wound being healed, she doesn't simply emphasize its civil authority. It has to be in a position where it can persecute once again. But modern Rome is illustrated by the papacy the first. And in Revelation 13:2, it says that pagan Rome gave the papacy three things. It gave its seat in the year 330. It gave its power from 496 to 508. And it gave its civil authority in 533. So, and the pioneers talk about this. The pioneers say, even though it was given its civil authority in 533, it was not able to exercise that civil authority until the Goths, the last of the three horns, was removed in 538. So even in the history of the papacy the first, you see that the civil authority is returned prior to the time period when the deadly wound is healed, when all three obstacles are overcome and it can persecute. It has to not only have its civil authority, but it has to be in the position to persecute again. That's why when it's talking about the ten kings in Revelation 17 agreeing to give their kingdom to under the beast, it also says the ten kings are the ones that go to make war.
So a correct theory was it began to heal in 1999.
Yes. Yeah, definitely a step. But she isn't in the position where she's going to have a bloodbath yet.
Okay. Thank you.